The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. Richard Martin here. This is Friday the 13th, or as it is commonly believed, it is Friday the 13th every day in America. Well, just to keep you in touch with the grim disintegration of the economy, let's start out with a few facts. A record number of 44 million, or 1 in 7 Americans, half of whom are children, are currently enrolled in the food stamp program. Additionally, government-affiliated food banks and other community and faith-based food pantries and soup kitchens served more than 37 million Americans, according to Feeding America's 2010 hunger study. This figure is up 46% from 2006. And I quote from Kevin Concannon, USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition and Consumer Services, who is charged with administering the 15 federally funded nutrition programs. This is a record number of Americans who are voluntarily seeking emergency food assistance. Not since the Great Depression has this kind of assistance been as urgently needed as now. End of quote. Well, despite those numbers, many struggling middle-class families don't know they are entitled to these benefits, even those who own a home or have a job. Just one-third of people who qualify for a major federal nutrition program are currently enrolled to receive their eligible benefits, according to the USDA. U.S. home values posted their largest quarter-over-quarter decline since the fourth quarter of 2008, falling 3%. Home values have fallen 29.5% from their peak in June 2006. Negative equity reached a new high with 28.4% of all single-family homes with mortgages underwater, up from 27% in the fourth quarter of 2010, due to accelerating home value declines. Institutions which have served low-income people in the state for more than 100 years represent a significant development that's gone largely unnoticed as the nation climbs out of recession. Many charity hospitals already struggling with rising costs are on the brink of failure because of looming budget cuts, increasing numbers of uninsured patients, and a slow economic recovery. Safety net hospitals have closed in Florida, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and New York in recent years. Of the 15 hospitals shut down in New York City last decade, 5 were safety net hospitals. Another filed for bankruptcy, and from the recession start through mid-2009, the number of patients seeking free care at the hospitals increased 23%, according to the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems. Patients who had insurance lost it when they lost their jobs, leaving the hospital to absorb the costs. Homelessness has skyrocketed, according to the results of a new census. Ron Stewart, DPSS Director, Riverside County's Homeless Programs, isn't surprised. Quote, It's another result of this downturned economy. The overall unemployment rate in the United States is 9%, but nearly a quarter of those between 16 and 19 are unemployed. Most will not be able to find the traditional summer jobs, which traditionally prepare them for work in the outside world when they leave school. Consumer spending in the U.S. remained flat in April, according to a Gallup poll released this week, as high gas, food, and other commodity prices likely restrained Americans' purchasing habits. According to the report, consumers' self-reported daily spending in stores, restaurants, gas stations, and online averaged $65 a day last month, compared to $64 in March, a statistically insignificant difference. Dennis Jacob, chief economist at Gallup, had this to say. Consumer spending over the first 4 months of 2011 is virtually unchanged from the same period last year and in 2009. Nearly 2 years after economists declared the recession over, spending remains far below the pre-economic crisis levels of early 2008. End of quote. The 2007-2009 recession has taken a toll on employment-based health coverage, a new report by the Employee Benefit Research Institute concludes. The percentage of workers with coverage through their own job fell to 52% in 2009. The percentage of workers with coverage as a dependent fell to 16.3% in 2009. Rising unemployment and the fact that some business owners have responded to the economic squeeze by dropping health benefits, scaling them back, or asking workers to pay more caused the decline, according to the report. Small business owner pessimism worsened in April for a second consecutive month, according to data released Tuesday. The National Federation of Independent Businesses Small Business Optimism Index dropped 0.7 points in April. That followed a 2.6-point decline in March. The NFIB called the April index, quote, a disappointing outcome following the March decline, end of quote. The report said economy and political uncertainty were dimming the outlook. The drags mentioned by NFIB members concluded, or rather included, the government deficit, a potential inflation threat, rising gas prices. The sub-index of expected business conditions in the next 6 months fell 3 percentage points to -8%, and the expected higher real sales index slipped 1 point to 5%. Vacancies at U.S. regional malls rose to the highest in at least a decade in the first quarter, a sign that landlords are struggling to keep tenants after the recession, even as retail sales increased. Rees Inc. said the vacancy rate climbed to 9.1% from 8.9% a year earlier and 8.7% in the fourth quarter. And that was according to Reese, the New York-based research firm, in a recent report. It was the highest since Reese began publishing data on regional malls in 2000. Underfunding of state and local pension plans is critical. From a summary issued by the Congressional Budget Office, and I quote, the recent financial crisis and economic recession have left many states and localities with extraordinary budgetary difficulties for the next few years. But structural shortfalls in their pension plans pose a problem that is likely to endure for much longer. This issue brief discusses alternative approaches to assessing the size of those shortfalls and the implications of those approaches for funding decisions. By any measure, nearly all state and local pension plans are underfunded, which means that the value of the plan's assets is less than their accrued pension liabilities for current workers and retirees. For the last 4 years, politicians, journalists, and analysts have been saying almost on a daily basis housing prices have bottomed out, even though that's mathematically impossible in view of the 7 to 10 million homes that are in foreclosure or close to foreclosure. These are the same people who in 2004-07 were saying that there was no housing bubble in the first place. In fact, the opposite is happening, according to Zillow. Home values fell 3% in the first quarter of this year, accelerating to the fastest rate since 2008. 28% of homes are now underwater, compared to just 22% a year ago. Last year's claims that housing prices had bottomed out were the result of being propped up in 2009 and early 2010 by federal stimulus programs, such as tax credits worth up to $8,000 for first-time home buyers, according to Zillow chief economist Stan Humphries in a Bloomberg interview. That program, quote, was stealing demand from the future. Now that the stimulus programs have ended, the housing crash is accelerating again. The housing bubble grew for 11 years before it was popped, and by the law of mean reversion, we can expect the housing collapse to continue for a roughly equivalent period of time, continuing through almost all of the current decade. You know, the country has been divided into two economies. One is the economy of Wall Street and corporate Manhattan, along with Washington's thriving economy of lobbyists, politicians, ex-politicians, national security contractors, and assorted hangers-on. Then there's the other economy, the one where most people live. It's a catastrophe, and it's getting worse. Guess which one is getting more attention and care in Washington, D.C.? The next time somebody celebrates a report that reads 244,000 new jobs were created in April, which is 20,000 more than the previous month, remember there are 7.5 million fewer jobs now than before the financial crisis. We need roughly 150,000 new jobs every month just to keep up with new job seekers. Of the 244,000 new jobs created last month, roughly one in four of them, 62,000, were at McDonald's, which, remember, is now turning away more applicants than Harvard. One grown man in three isn't working. That's a record. Long-term unemployment is at record highs. African Americans are hit much harder by unemployment in this Jim Crow depression. Young people are hard hit too, which dooms many of them to a lifetime of lower earnings. Older, long-term unemployed Americans have essentially been discarded, unlikely to find a new job and slipping down the ladder into a life of chronic deprivation. For every job that opens up, there are 4.5 or 5 people looking for work. The total number of unemployed, underemployed, and discouraged workers, along with the unemployed, is approximately 25 million people, or an underemployed rate of 15.9%. President after president from both parties has pledged to end poverty. Forget it. Since the financial crisis, more than 2 million Americans have fallen into poverty. More than 43 million people now live below the poverty line. More than 20% of the country's children now live in poverty. More than twice the figure for children in Great Britain or France. And more than one household in 20 lives with what is called extreme food insecurity, which means normal eating patterns have been disrupted at times during the year because it didn't have the money for food. Most of the middle class has kept its wealth in housing, something bankers and government leaders encouraged them to do. Thanks to Wall Street, that wealth is gone, replaced by debt for real estate value that no longer exists. Residential real estate has lost more than $6 trillion in value since 2008, after 57 consecutive months of decline. although a large chunk of that money is still being repaid as bank loans. $6 trillion is lost value, and the banks are government and are quibbling about a proposed $20 billion settlement for mortgage fraud. Well, let's take a question from John in Brooklyn, who would like to talk about shorting the market and wants to know if Fukushima will have an effect on the market. Hello, John. How are you?
Hello, Richie. Good morning. I was just wondering if it's, you know, you heard you talk about that might be the only safe thing to do in the future with the history of the market now, what may happen. Is it too early to start to do that, or should you do it soon? And, you know, people have been talking about there's going to be a big correction maybe, but they were saying that'll be in some time. Did Fukushima actually speed that up? And if so, what does that mean for you, like 401ks, and what should you do with it?
Well, 401ks, IRAs, any kind of account where you're bound to have long positions in stocks should be liquidated immediately. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that we've reached the top, or we are within, you know, a few feet of the top here. As far as shorting the market, John, I think you should short the market. I think if you short overpriced stocks which are living with very high PEs, then I think your risk is very minimal and your profit potential is very great. So I would go ahead and do that and just stay with the positions until they move in your favor. Fukushima, I think, will have an effect on the market. Yes, most definitely I do. We don't even know the extent of the trouble. It seems that one of the reactors appears, from what I've read, to be in partial meltdown right now. I think it is much more serious than they're able even to tell, even if they were of a mind to tell the truth, which I'm not sure that they are. Yes, of course it will be an immense pressure on the market when the full implications of this thing become known. You're going to already have lost an enormous market for Western-produced goods and indeed Chinese-produced ones in the form of Japan, who will be fighting for its life and trying to engage in a program of reconstruction. So it is a very grim situation altogether, and one in which I may say the 60-year top in commodity prices has just hit yesterday, which means that, and by the way, the 60-year cycle is by far and away the most reliable cycle of all cycles in commodities, which presages a stunning decline in all commodities, including gold and silver. And the other precious metals. So I feel that we are in a heavily deflationary environment, and one in which, quite frankly, we will be staying for a good long while to come yet. So any investment that you make which takes into account deflation will, in my opinion, make money. And so I hope that that's answered your question, John, and I appreciate it. It's a very relevant and prescient question to ask, and I'm hoping that it will have helped other people also with their own plans for the future.
Thank you. Let me ask you one other question. If you have an opportunity to write a letter to people who are fiduciaries to a pension fund that you're in, what would you advise them to do in this point?
Well, I did. This came up actually a while back when I suggested people take their money out of treasury bill, or rather regular commercial money market funds, and put them into treasury bill money market funds. And I had enormous number of people coming to tell me that their 401k plans simply didn't contain any kind of treasury bill money market fund. I suggested, in fact, I even wrote out a letter at one point suggesting that they write to their administrators complaining that such was not the case and threatening that they were fiduciary indeed, and that they had their money in their safekeeping, and that if they did not pay attention to the dangers of the various kinds of money fund that were being offered, that the individual holders would hold the fund responsible.
I don't know what kind of success that had, but I do know that it's a hop, skip, and a jump to include a Treasury bill money market fund in any 401k. It's a mere stroke of the pen, and when they try to claim that it's terribly difficult and they need this and that authorization and to talk to this person and that person, the administrator's assistant, it's all nonsense. They can do it at the stroke of a pen. So I do think that you should write, if you're not satisfied with the investments offered, I think you should write a fairly threatening letter to the administrator stating that you will hold them responsible, that you wish to be in a maximum condition of safety and security, and you're not filled with the idea that they may be holding investments which are going to be severely impacted in any coming downturn, John. Yes, I think it's a very good idea.
What about if it's a defined benefit plan instead of a 401k?
Well, there's that you can do, much less you can do in a defined benefit plan, because you hold no control over the investment you make. So you're in a much, much more difficult position in a defined benefit plan. I doubt that there's much pressure that you can put on people or influence that you can have over their investments. It's up to them to produce the returns they're supposed to produce, and you have a different kind of claim on them, which is the claim for what they've promised you in terms of a return. So I would tend to look at the problem from that point of view rather than trying to interfere in their specific investment policy.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, John. Thank you. Well, housing values are down by a third over the last 3 years. Even more ominously, they're down 4.6% since their 2009 lows, and they are still falling. Fewer homes were sold in the first 3 months of this year than, well, since they started keeping records. 8 million homeowners are now at least 1 month behind on their mortgage payments. Young people aren't just jobless. College tuition has gone up 900% since 1978. The country's total student debt is now greater than its credit card debt and will reach $1 trillion this year. And in a statistic that should bring tears to any thoughtful person's eyes, only 44% of those polled believe that children will have, quote, a better life than their parents. 10 years ago, that figure was 71%. Like the old song says, the dream is over. Gasoline went up 30% over the last 12 months. Crops are lousy this year, so food prices are going to go up. Consumer confidence is falling. When consumers aren't confident, they don't spend money. And when they don't spend money, people don't work. Small business confidence is falling too. Why shouldn't it? Their customers don't feel like buying very much. Bear in mind, for the wealthy, one person in 100, things are great. They now own one-third of everything. Well, 50% of Americans own 2.5% of everything. Meanwhile, the other 99 people are watching their dreams of a better life die, and there's no serious talk about investing to create jobs and turn this economy around. There's jive talk instead. Business doesn't like economic uncertainty, we're told, so it won't hire and invest. But John Boehner just went to Wall Street and threatened to bring about an economic collapse if his radical demands weren't met. That's a recipe for massive uncertainty. And how did business react? The stock market went up. They're pushing job-creating tax breaks for big businesses and wealthy individuals, even though corporations are sitting on $2 trillion in cash, and the wealthiest are richer than they've ever been in any time in modern history. It simply does not compute. Meanwhile, the people who caused this catastrophe, the banks, are being unleashed from the few restraints that were imposed on them last year. It's increasingly clear that the government still has no tools for winding down a too-big-to-fail bank when it's imploding. There's no political discussion about turning these explosive banks into something smaller and less combustible. Pretty smart people are beginning to agree that the government hasn't been given the tools it needs to prevent the next crash. If humanity is becoming more rational, how is that for a debatable question? People will one day look back on this moment with amazement, awe, and pity. They'll wonder how a few influential people could be so blind and so heartless when so many people are so broken-hearted. Self-interest plays a big part too, of course. Politicians win campaign contributions this way. Misguided Democrats can fool themselves into thinking they look moderate for embracing the nation's warped priorities and compromising with its radical demands. Journalists can repeat false economic truisms, secure in the knowledge that editors and billionaire-funded foundations will have their back. The real question isn't why so many people serve the system. It's why the rest of us tolerate it. Why do people still vote for politicians who work against their interests, or watch and read journalists who fail to report the facts impartially and thoroughly? All right, this is Richard Martin, and this is the Wake Up Call coming to you from Singapore. And I invite you all to follow in John's footsteps and call me on 888-874-4888. And the best thing about the call, ladies and gentlemen, it is that it's free. It is toll-free. Once again, the number is 888-874-4888. And it's open entirely throughout the show, so call in and we will take your call just like we did in the case of John and hopefully give you satisfaction. If, on the other hand, you would prefer to write in your question, you can write into the email, which is my personal email, open all the time at rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, the email rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my own direct line, which is accessible through Sarasota's area code 941-441-1682. And that's available to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to discuss your own personal situation with me in private. If I'm not here, leave your name and a phone number. Once again, the number is area code 941-441-1682. Well, let's just take one of Steve Kruger's rants quickly before the break, and it reads as follows. Richard, it damn near brings me to tears to read a newspaper article that prints the truth. You have to go to Asia to find real journalism. Imagine that, actually reporting of news. In America and Europe, we have news readers. I equate them to a flock of parrots repeating what the line of the day is. Like I said in a previous rant, the people of North Africa are not spontaneously seeking democracy. The common thread that binds them together is a half-empty stomach. When you are hungry, you will do anything to fill your needs. And this has not a damn thing to do with the longing for freedom. The Western press is touting the freedom line simply because it continues the feeding of the war machine. Our government and press has lost its ability to tell the truth, that the American public has been sufficiently dumbed down and can't recognize a lie. American apathy will continue as long as we're supersized and have very full stomachs. When we do wake up, I'm afraid it'll be too late. Steve Kruger. Well, now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the press, because I think it bears discussion. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a break, and I'll be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Did you miss your favorite show on Progressive Radio Network? Well, no need to worry. We have all of our shows archived on our website. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and find the show you're looking for.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, the John Rappaport Show.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Okay, we're back. And, you know, one of the key causes of the decline of the corporate mainstream media is that the MSM no longer publishes or airs anything that challenges the status quo. The timidity of the corporate media knows no bounds. They're either bought off, sold out, or compromised. In web-based corporate media, so-called journalism has been distilled down to churning out lists. The 11 best cities to do your 50 million IPO in. The 9 most adorable dog breeds. 7 reasons why we hate corporate web-based media. You'll never see that list, etc. Anyway, the print media has always lived off advertising. What's changed is the overt slavishness of the media towards its advert masters. If you flip through a corporate mainstream media publication from the late 1960s, for example, Life magazine, you will see plenty of adverts. You'll also see uncompromising stories about alternative lifestyles, about demonstrators against the status quo being beaten, arrested, and thrown in temporary gulags, and other stories which simply call the entire machinery of the status quo into question. The deal was this. The media was relevant, so people wanted to read it. Advertisers who wanted to reach this audience had to suck it up and advertise regardless of whether they approved of the content. A near monopoly certainly aided the corporate media pre-cable TV, the Internet. There was a handful of national print media outlets, 2 big newspapers per major city, a town newspaper in smaller burgs, and 3 national TV networks.
advertisers had little choice about where to place their advert dollars. Now that advertisers have a vast spectrum of choice, they have the upper hand. The media outlets have to sell their audience to advertisers. Please give us the money, because our audience is huge or targeted and, oh yes, in all cases, special. The media, corporate and non-traditional alike, can count on subscriptions to pay the basic bills. No more. Free, so-called, content is, of course, not free. Somebody has to pay the electricity bills for the servers and the staff to post the content, even if it's skimmed from the other sites. In a world of free content, why pay for content? Why indeed? Well, there are two reasons. One, loyalty to the voice provided by the magazine, channel, radio station, newspaper, blog, etc. In some cases, this might be the loyalty of those who love to hear their own views confirmed on a routine basis, the true believers. In other cases, the loyalty is for telling it like it is, even if the positions don't always align with the reader's own views. The other reason is that the public channel station is indispensable. Everyone who is anyone reads, watches, or listens to it. What makes a media outlet indispensable? One, it is skeptical about received wisdom and official explanations, and two, it has a strong and unique voice. You tell me there is any corporate media that meets these standards? Perhaps on a good day, here and there, but consistently, no. The liberal media parrots the same old tiresome Keynesian blather that we need to borrow another $10 trillion, oh heck, make it $20 trillion, or $100 trillion, because we need to pay our teachers and cops a living wage. Unions are the backbone of the country. All we need to do is tax the top 1% and all our problems will be solved, etc. The conservative media parrots the same old tiresome corporate welfare blather that we need a strong defense, never mind the cost. Cutting taxes is the solution to all our problems. So while we wait for that magic to work, we have to borrow another $10 trillion. Oh, heck, make that $20 or $100 trillion. And government shouldn't be intrusive unless it's enforcing our standards on everyone else. And then central state tyranny is morally necessary. All corporate media reprints central state propaganda with only the faintest mewling skepticism. Take the reporting of the monthly unemployment figures as an example. The media broadcast or headline blares, unemployment down as economy recovers. If there was any skepticism left, and even the faintest shred of principled devotion to the truth, the headline should read, government spins unemployment numbers again, keeps pushing propaganda. We all know that that's the reality, the truth, that the unemployment statistics are doctored, tweaked, and massaged to play the same message again and again. Unemployment is down. Never mind, it's because we removed 4 million people from the workforce. The economy is recovering, because if you stop believing that, you might rise up against the status quo. The corporate media is fatally timid because it's running scared. The focus is on profits that must be made and shipped to restive shareholders and managers, and on keeping a job to pay a mortgage. You know, the grand irony is the solution to decline is to stand for something other than corporate profits. Do you read what passes for editorials in the corporate media? The same old cliches are trotted out, the same bland, milquetoast positions, so-called, that mean nothing, say nothing, signify nothing but complicity and surrender. The government should keep spending until we get out of recession, or the government should spend responsibly, blah, blah, blah. In other words, let's play journalism, not as if it mattered, but as a game where the winners attract eyeballs and clicks with eye-catching lists and low-cut blouses, and snagging adverts is the only real goal. Well, the same thing happened as happens today in the 1930s. People were sent to jail then because of the Pecora Commission. Here's how it was described in the 1939 book, since yesterday by Frederick Lewis Allen, and I quote, "Intermittently throughout the year 1933, the Senate Committee on Banking and Currency, with the aid of its inexorable counsel Ferdinand Pecora, had been putting on one of the most extraordinary shows ever produced in a Washington committee room, a sort of protracted coroner's inquest upon American finance. One by one, a long line of financial overlords, commercial bankers, investment bankers, railroad and public utility holding company promoters, stockbrokers, and big speculators had filed up to the witness table, and from these unwilling gentlemen and from their office files had been extracted a sorry story of public irresponsibility and private greed. Day by day, this story had been spread upon the front pages of the newspapers. The investigation showed how pool operators in Wall Street had manipulated the prices of stocks on the exchange with the assistance of men inside the companies with whose securities they toyed. It showed how they had made huge profits, which represented the exercise of no socially useful function at the expense of the little speculators and of investors generally, and had fostered a speculative mania which had racked the whole economic system of the country. And this not only in 1928 and 1929, but as recently as the spring of 1933, when Roosevelt was in the White House and Wall Street had supposedly been wearing the sackcloth and ashes of repentance. The investigation showed, too, how powerful bankers had unloaded stocks and bonds upon the unwary through high-pressure salesmanship and had made millions trading in the securities of their own banks at the expense of stockholders whose interests they claimed to be serving. It showed how the issuing of new securities had been so organized as to yield rich fruits to those on the inside, and how opportunities to taste these fruits had been offered to gentlemen of political influence. It showed how that modern engine of financial power, the holding company, had been misused by promoters, how some of these promoters had piled company upon company till the structures of corporate influence were 7 or 8 stories high, how these structures had become so complex that they were readily looted by unscrupulous men and so unstable that many of them came crashing down during the Depression. It showed how grave could be the results when the holding company technique was applied to banking. It showed how men of wealth had used devices like the personal holding company and tricks like the sale of stock at a loss to members of their families to dodge the tax collector at the very moment when men of humbler station had been paying the taxes which supported the government. Again and again, it showed how men occupying fiduciary positions in the financial world had been false to their trust. That's exactly what's happening today, right? Except that there's no Pecora commission to throw these people in jail. There are too many regulators, analysts, journalists, and politicians, Democrats and Republicans, in bed with the crooks to risk delving too deeply. When the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission hearings began in Congress a couple of years ago, I had hoped that they would perform the same role as the Pecora Commission, especially when they elicited testimony that proved mathematically that the banksters had committed fraud. However, it was obviously disappointing to see that the FCIC hearings essentially came to nothing. Who is out there to do the job of Ferdinand Pecora? As I suspected, Ron Paul is a tiny voice in the wilderness, fading by the day. It looks like he's more interested in his presidential aspirations than in coming out swinging against the powers that be. Because I can tell you, anybody that does what Pecora does hasn't got a hope of being elected to anything. He's probably going to be lucky enough to keep his life. He won't be supported by any institution in any of the political parties, and he will be at the end of the line when it comes to being selected for office he will simply be marginalized, just like Paul was back in the previous presidential run-up. Not a hope of being anywhere near the electoral machine. Well, the international trade data is showing a widening between what America exports and imports. The gap grew from $45.8 billion in February to $48.2 billion in March, largely on the back of rising oil prices. High oil prices eventually raised the price of everything, even the trade deficits. Of course, since the U.S. is running still massive deficits, it needs to pay for them somehow, and that would mean more debt via bond or treasury sales and more printing. In this space, the country lost its way a long time ago, exporting far less than it imported and not really paying for any of it. Can you imagine working to produce products to sell to a country who returns you only financial engineering for decade upon decade? That's just another measurement that's made in dollars. And this points out the fantasy of money printing to inflate away debts. Note that the more you print, the larger this deficit gets, because all other real things are priced in dollars. Thus, the debt is growing faster because you printed, which is the exact opposite of what you are told will happen by people who simply have been brainwashed with the Fed's BS. And let me say that again to make it clear. Printing does not reduce your debts. It increases them. If you don't believe that, then take a look at the U.S. debt since the time QE began and report back. No, ladies and gentlemen, America has truly lost its way. The introduction of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913 was the beginning of a very slippery slope. Initially, the introduction of debt-backed money created a boom, but now the country is totally saturated with debt. Your collective incomes are completely, utterly, and totally incapable of ever paying it back. This is a moral decline, and it has accelerated greatly with the removal of usury laws. Taking advantage of people via production of money has always been a sin and always will be. The production of money is the most powerful right that exists. It is as powerful as all of human imagination. That power rightfully belongs to everyone, not a few individuals who have been wrongfully staked in their claim to that power. The people of Europe are being sold down the river while paper is being created by the central bankers to mask it over. Paper that enslaves future generations. The impossible math there is staring everyone point blank in the eyes. The people of Europe need to send the central bankers packing, but their money is corrupting politicians and their political systems as it is in the United States. Keep an eye not only on Europe, but also on Japan. The media ignored disaster there is certainly not over, and in fact there are several risks that are further threatening Fukushima. The real news there is only deteriorating. The contamination is far worse than let on. It is spread far further than let on, and there is still a risk that it could get worse. The banking system is nothing but fraud, completely controlled by the same people. The whole shebang is coming down, and other events are coming. That is what happens when people lose their way. Okay, well, Steve Kruger seems to be the one who comes in loud and clear with rants and emails, so let me take another of Steve's offerings. Richard, I listened to Monday's show on the archives and the sound quality has improved. I'm glad to hear that, Steve. It was interesting what you said about restrictions on getting a passport. When the government puts in place high hurdles by requiring obscure information on your passport application, to me it means at some point they're going to slow down people from leaving the country. When they ask an applicant who was in the room when he was born and what they had for breakfast, they're trying to prevent a mass exodus. And don't make a mistake on the application or jail time is waiting for you. The people who will be deterred from leaving will be those who pay their taxes. The country is broke and they're going to nickel and dime us to death. Make no mistake about it. This is a virtual fence, not at our borders, but around each citizen. It is as real as the Berlin Wall. Without a passport, you will be staying home. Your papers will not be in order. Another example of American creativity, a wall around our country without spending a dime or setting one brick. If they think you're going to run, you'll be denied a passport. Wow, reality has George Orwell beat by a mile. Steve Kruger. Well, let me give you something from Simon Black, who is an up-and-coming analyst, commentator that I read more and more. He has this to say about Chile, which he calls the New America. And if you're looking for a place where you can be expected to take care of yourself, where you are responsible for your own successes and failures, and where the government stays out of your business, this is your place. One of the things that I enjoy so much about Chile is its growing business culture and how hungry the government is to compete for productive people, regardless of where they come from. Yesterday in the Huffington Post, there was an article that captured something that I hadn't read yet anywhere else in the mainstream press, and I was surprised to see it. Chile is actually beginning to challenge the United States as favored entrepreneurial destination. Many Americans are shunning their homeland and hopping a plane for Santiago, where the comparisons to California not only apply to the fantastic weather, gorgeous landscape, and mellow people, but also to Silicon Valley's savvy tech startup culture. Many are calling it Chilicon Valley. This is some haphazard handing photo op for the government to show that they're doing something about entrepreneurship. President Sebastian Piñera is a self-made billionaire. He understands the best way to maintain Chile's economic growth is to create homegrown companies capable of producing the next big thing. The government recently launched a program called Startup Chile, which provides $40,000 in working capital to entrepreneurs and a host of other incentives like residency and work permits for foreign labor. There are many success stories from this program already, and this is no small feat. You see, a culture that embraces entrepreneurialism is a culture that accepts failure. The two go hand in hand. No successful businessman has a perfect track record. In fact, most have a record of terrible failures. I certainly do, and I've learned more from my failures, both investment and business, than any success. Yet in many of the machismo cultures across Latin America, commercial failure is regarded as a matter of dishonor. If one fails at business, he has embarrassed himself, his family, and his teacher. For this reason, most people just avoid the prospect of starting their own business. It's not worth the risk of humiliation. The risk-averse mentality has slowly begun to change in Chile, and they've done it in part by infusing society with foreigners who have the experience and personal anecdotes to say, hey, it's okay to fail. University programs now abound with business and entrepreneurial programs talking about the benefits and lessons learnt in failure. You even see advertisements on buses now encouraging people to turn their ideas into reality. Meanwhile, the government has been rolling out the red carpet for foreign entrepreneurs with the idea that local Chileans will be able to learn from their technical expertise and business experience. Foreigners are all too eager to come. It's becoming more and more of a burden to be a productive citizen in the United States, with so much government regulation being passed and pending that is absolutely crippling to startups. The next Google, whether it's in the green energy, biotech, or agricultural space, needs the opportunity to flourish in an environment that's rich on talent, incentives, and cost-effective infrastructure, and low on burdensome regulatory and administrative hurdles. More and more, Chile is fulfilling this role better, than the United States. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was from Simon Black, and I urge you all to take note. Chile is a very nice country. I've been there several times on business. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. The people are friendly and warm, and business is well looked upon over there. The business climate is very healthy, and you are next to Argentina, another country which I think will be an excellent venue for the coming depression. So Chile it is, ladies and gentlemen. Get thyselves over there, PDQ. Well, billionaire hedge fund manager Rajarat was convicted on Wednesday of 14 counts of insider trading, according to Bloomberg. He had a network of insiders at companies like Intel, Goldman Sachs, Google, and Hilton Hotels, who provided him with specific information about earnings, forecasts, and mergers in advance of public information, and then he traded on that information. He made $63.8 million from illegal insider trading. He's expected to be sentenced to about 19 years in jail. One can understand and sympathize with someone living on the edge who steals a loaf of bread to feed his family, or even an ordinary employee who makes a couple of $1,000 by purchasing some stock after hearing some insider news. But here you have a billionaire who blatantly broke the law to make $60 million or more. Listening to some of the wiretap recordings on TV, you can hear what contempt he has for the rules. This is a man who considers breaking the law for his own gain, bilking the system, bilking ordinary investors, treating it like a fun video game where he had a higher score than other crooks. Even so, it's almost a miracle that he was charged with anything. William Black, no relation to Simon Black, was the prosecutor and senior regulator investing the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. He had thousands of criminal referrals and got over 1,000 priority felony convictions of the elites, the top people at the savings and loans. By contrast, today's regulatory agencies had zero criminal referrals, not one, according to Black. This is a crisis we know empirically involved millions of fraudulent mortgages being made. We know that the losses are out there. We know that the industry extorted FASB to gimmick the accounting rules so they didn't have to recognize the losses. We know that the Fed has huge positions as collateral in these fraudulent mortgages. We've seen the Fed, AmBac, Fannie, Freddie, PIMCO, BlackRock, all putting back after investigating tens of billions of dollars of mortgages and saying these were sold under false representations and warranties, frauds, and absolutely no one has gone to jail for it. End of quote. Black points to collusion between the FBI and the Mortgage Bankers Association, the Trade Association of the Perps, as he puts it, as one reason. The reason that there were thousands of criminal referrals in the 1980s savings and loan crisis is because the silent generation who had a sense of ethics was still in charge at that time. The reason that there are zero criminal referrals in today's crisis is because the boomers and Gen Xers are in charge, and today's regulators are just as crooked and incompetent as the perpetrators and have no morality or ethics. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's up to you. And nobody else is going to do these things. Unfortunately, there's still too much complacency. There are too many people who think that they can gain a free ride off the back of others. And quite frankly, they're correct up until now. So the system must decline and disintegrate by itself and on its own terms, without apparently the aid of the people who should know better. It's very sad and very tragic. But I guess we're all going to have to take ringside seats and watch patiently as the system disintegrates and the depression takes hold. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, ladies and gentlemen. This is the wake-up call coming to an end, and I shall wish you all a wonderful weekend. Be back with you on Monday, 10 a.m. As always, this is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.